Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 178 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and on this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 25 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. I've got another great show for you today. Brett is joining me again, and we're going to have a nice little chat, GM to GM. We're discussing a whole slew of topics today, but among them are some general GM philosophies and tips, and I go into some detail on my upcoming campaign, as well as some new information on my homebrew world of Primordia. So really looking forward to getting Brett on here again today. We've got a lot of great stuff to talk about, and I hope that you will enjoy our discussion. Really quickly, I want to remind you that we do have Game Master's Journey t-shirts available now that you can pick up and show off to all your game playing friends. And you can find a link to our store on Spreadshirt at the website starwalkerstudios.com, and you can check out the various designs that we have, and you can get things other than t-shirts. If you watch the video for the last episode 177, which was the most recent live stream, I'm actually sporting my new Game Master's Journey t-shirt that I got. And among the many things that you can get on the store are aprons. So I really need an apron because every time I cook, I just get grease all over me. So I think I might get myself some kind of apron, maybe a Trickster's Labyrinth apron. That would be cool. But anyway, yeah, definitely check out our store on Spreadshirt. My wife, Nikki, designed the shirts, and they're really awesome. And again, not just shirts, all kinds of stuff. Also, I have a D&D adventure available for purchase, the Trickster's Labyrinth. It's an adventure for third level characters. You can use it in any setting. It works as it's a little bit long for a one shot, but it works as a one off adventure, or you can easily slap it into an ongoing campaign. And a huge thank you to everyone who's purchased that. I really appreciate your support. And finally, also want to let you know that we now have a Discord server for Star Walker Studios, and you can go there and hang out with other listener GMs and talk about whatever you want to talk about. We've been having a lot of fun in there, and we have people in there every day now having nice little chats. So we have our community on Google+, which is a great place to go if you have something more substantial to say. Maybe you want to share some details about your homebrew setting, or you have a story you want to tell about a recent game session, or you have a more in-depth question that you want to ask. The Google+ community is there for all those things, and also a great place to share inspirational artwork, all kinds of stuff like that. The Discord is, in addition to that, and is a place where you can chat more in real time. So it's more better for doing real time conversations with people. It's a lot of fun. We also have a voice room that you can go into where you can actually use a microphone and talk with other people using your voice and your ears, which is awesome. And very soon, Discord is going to have video capability, and I don't know yet if we'll be able to have a public video room or not, but I'm really excited about that because I'm planning to use it for my next campaign for the video chat. So I'm really excited. I've had good experiences with Google Hangouts up to this point for gaming, but they've removed their API functionality. So there used to be a nice dice rolling app that someone made for it that worked really well. And those things are not working so much anymore. And a lot of the functionality of Google+ is going away for whatever reason. So it's really nice to have Discord, which is a service created with gamers in mind, unlike Google Plus. And you can get dice rollers on there, and it's really nice. One thing I like about it is it's set up more like a Mumble or a TeamSpeak or a Ventrilo server. So you can have numerous rooms, which is really awesome. So, you know, now on Roll20, they have a function in the chat where you can have a private chat with one of the players, and it kind of mutes the two of you for everyone else. So you can kind of have a little secret conversation. But Roll20's video chat is problematic, to put it nicely. It has problems far more often than it works without problem. At least that's been my experience over the years. So I'm really excited to get away from Roll20 chat. And with Discord, you can set up numerous rooms. So it's really easy if you want to take one or a few of the players aside and have a private conversation. You can easily do that on the Discord server. So it's going to be fantastic for running and playing games online. I'm really excited. But right now, the text and the voice chat is up and going on our server. So please check it out and join in and say hi. And you can find a link to our Discord server as well in the show notes over at StarWalkerStudios.com. Well, that's enough, I think, at the top of the show here. Brett and I have a lot to talk about today. So without further ado, I'll just progress on with the episode. Did you ever read that blog post about fox hunts versus railroads?
No.
Someone posted to the group quite a while ago.
I don't think so. What is that?
It's a really cool blog post. Let me find it, and I'll give you a link to it. That I want to actually do an episode on it, because it was kind of like what we were talking about how just because you have a story, or just because you have a plot, or just because you have certain things you want the players to do or certain places you want them to go, doesn't mean it has to be a railroad.
Mm.
And it's all about how you approach it and kind of how you do what you're doing that determines whether or not it feels like a railroad. He said doing a fox hunt is like kind of like what we were talking about, where like one thing kind of leads to another. And the player characters, oh, here we go. The player characters are still making decisions. They're not being totally led by the nose. But he says, using a fox hunt to describe good linear stories, where a railroad is a bad linear story.
I think the gist of it is, and I think we even touched on this when we talked last, that I don't think I've ever, in the truest sense of the word, I don't think I've ever really been in a railroaded storyline. Unless I'm playing a board game or something like that, but everything seems to be more fox huntish.
Yeah, you know, when I see it the most is in the published stuff.
Yeah, so, I can see that. I've been going through the Curse of Strahd book, and that seems kind of it urges you toward one specific goal with no outside, no deviating from the path.
Yeah, so he's saying here there's, with a good linear campaign, there's one main goal that the PCs are trying to achieve, though there could be side quests. Although the central conflict remains the same, the campaign shifts dramatically in response to the PCs' decisions. This is because the entire campaign is based around one main conflict, so if the players force the antagonist to change, it ripples through the entire campaign. Player characters all have personal reasons to unify around the central conflict. Mm-hmm. There's a consistent feeling of momentum. Story builds towards a single climax. And he says, a railroad is weak on most of these characteristics. It has one main goal, but it fails to shift in response to the PC's actions. It's built to tell the GM story, not the PC story. So it's usually first and foremost about saving the world rather than achieving goals the players want for their characters. Though there might be a constant feeling of momentum, it's driven by outside threats, not the PC's internal drives. A fox hunt is a metaphor that describes a linear RPG done well. The hunters are the players. The hounds are their characters. The fox represents the object of the central conflict. Fox versus hounds, antagonists versus protagonists, villains versus PCs. So, yeah. I mean, there's more, but that's the gist.
Yeah.
So basically just making it about like your character's motivations. And I feel like that's more like doing session zero right, and having characters that fit the campaign and have motivations that are going to feed into what you're wanting to do even more than it is how you actually run the game, you know?
True. Okay, here's a question for you. How often do you often start off with a campaign or with a
session zero?
Session zero, thank you. Yeah.
I mean, kind of, yeah, because I mean, lately I run online. So we right. don't always necessarily have an actual like session zero, but you know, we'll have like a forum on Roll20 or whatever. And I'll say, you know, this is what the campaign's about. This is what kind of characters you can play. And then, you know, so it's like we kind of do a lot of the session zero stuff, but instead of us getting together for a session, it's more like over forums and stuff like that.
Sure. Okay. That makes sense.
So like the campaign I'm planning, I haven't done it yet because I don't want to, I want to, because in the past I have this really bad habit where I get excited about the campaign and I want to tell the players about it, right? But then as soon as I tell the players about it, they all decide what kind of characters they want to play.
Yes.
And I'm not ready yet. And then maybe some of the characters they come up with end up not fitting what I decide I want to do. And then I feel like it's too late. And so I'm trying really hard this time not to like spill the beans until I'm ready. but the plan is, you know, I'm going to, when I'm ready, say, okay, guys, here's what the campaign's going to be about. Here's what kind of characters would work really well for it. You know, here's what kind of characters won't work. You know, kind of that kind of stuff. Like, here's what to expect from the campaign, and here's how to make a character that's going to really fit this campaign well, as opposed to like you make a druid and we never go out in the wilderness, you know. It's right, a city-based right. campaign and you made a druid.
A politics-based, an urban politics-based campaign. And yeah.
And something I've consistently done poorly at is communicating like what kind of characters will work and what won't. And I think I've said this on the show before, where I feel like almost every campaign I've ever run, I have at least one player character that I feel doesn't really fit. Mm-hmm. But I see it as a failing on my part in communicating what I want. And so I don't want to like tell a player, no, you can't play your character because I didn't do a good job telling you what I was looking for. You know what I mean?
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Like for instance, in the campaign we're running now, which this wasn't really a big deal because it was just this like, you know, we're just doing Hidden Shrine. Like, I don't really care. It's just a beer and pretzels game. I'm not like super intense about it. But like Steve's character didn't really fit what I was envisioning because he made this like basically criminal character that
right.
that wasn't like heroic and all this stuff. And I ended up coming up with part of it was his backstory, but kind of together we came up with the idea that, you know, he used to be a pirate and he got caught. And instead of, you know, executing him or cutting his hands off or whatever they would have done, they instead said, well, you know, instead of being flogged or whatever, you know, you can join the guild and kind of make something of yourself kind of thing. So I kind of figured out a way to kind of fit his character into it, even though it originally, you know, I felt like it didn't fit what I was envisioning. But again, I never told Steve, like, this is what I'm looking for. You know what I mean? Like, so.
Yeah, totally. No, that makes complete sense. I was wondering about that because I've always taken a kind of a backwards approach to it, I guess, because I've never come into it. I've never started a campaign or I've never begun play with the players from the perspective of, okay, I've got this story. Now I need you guys to make your characters to participate in the story. It's always been, because it's, you know, it's just a bunch of friends getting together.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, we want to play D&D. I'm making a character. Well, I'm going to make this character. I'm going to make this character.
Yeah.
And we all kind of conglomerate. And then from those people come the story.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a, it's kind of more of a fluid approach to it that might not always work, but it's worked out well for our group.
Yeah. And I mean, to me, that seems more like the sandbox approach, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, very much.
I'm trying to remember. I've often thought I'd like to try that, doing it that way sometime. But I don't know that I ever have. I think part of it is just like, I like to prepare. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, if I'm going to come to session zero and be like, hey guys, make characters, and then I'll decide what I'm going to do. It's like, well, now I have a week to do all this prep that I would normally take a couple months to do, you know?
Right. Right.
So,
and I think from us too, from the players we've been playing with our friends, they kind of have, it was kind of fluid how we all started playing again. And, as I said before, we were taking turns DMing and kind of building one shot runs here and there. And it slowly morphed into this world that we have. And taking that, I think we had, trying to think when we first started, there was a barbarian. I think he was a barbarian. A ranger and the DM. So it was just the three of us playing. It was just the two characters and
okay.
And it's, you know, the and then the ranger played for a little while and then became a druid. And Terry brought in a druid for a little while and retired the ranger to do other things. Don't know what happened to him, actually. I wonder. I might come across him later.
Yeah.
And then the druid went away because he wanted to play a wizard. So the druid has a backstory going on right now that's, or a side story that's kind of in narrative mode. And, you know, while Terry is playing out Vaden the wizard, and Andy's character too, the one character that he started with wound up retiring and staying up north in that campaign. And then he became Drusk, the half-orc. And we've been continuing with that. So it's, I think because our group kind of switches between characters at the same time, it's both more difficult and a little easier to kind of run stories through whoever's playing or whatever character happens to be there. The difficult part is maintaining a plot or maintaining that history.
Yeah.
Because there were people that the original characters had interacted with a great deal, who you guys have actually come across later on, but nobody in the party knows them. It's weird. So they're like the captain of the guard in Sarath. There was a big interaction with them and different areas that you guys have found yourself in, like the ruins when Vaden was arrested and taken back when you were deposited from the Shadow Realm. That ruined area, the previous characters had all participated in an action that was there. And so it's kind of funny revisiting those places with different characters and remembering who knows what and what experiences were where.
Yeah. I think that kind of thing, and I mean, you can tell me what you think, but I think that kind of thing is easier also when you're running in your own setting as opposed to like a published setting. I've just in my history, it seemed a lot easier when I'm running in my own setting to kind of wing things.
Oh, absolutely.
And not prep as much, because I feel part of it is I feel like I have this freedom where I can just make stuff up and I don't have to worry about, oh, it does that fit the canon or whatever. Mm-hmm. And part of it's just, I just have a better grasp of it in my head than I will ever have of like the Forgotten Realms. So I can kind of just make these decisions on the fly and worry about like how that's all going to fit together later.
Right. You can make it canon as it happens. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. That's a big help. I've only, if I remember correctly, I think I've only run as a GM. I've only run one published campaign, and I don't think we saw it all the way through.
Okay.
And that was back in the Rollmaster days.
Okay.
But, so everything has been homebrewed, either my world or or you know, one of the other DMs that were playing, that we were playing back and forth, or in their world. So it's tricky. I actually have less experience in published campaigns than I do in homebrews.
I think it's if people think that running published campaigns is easier, I think that's a misconception. I think it's different skills. I mean, it's very different, and it, you know, I could see one GM being really good at running published stuff and another GM not, but, or one GM being good at homebrew and another not, you know, because they're very different.
True. Either way though, there's no, and I think you might've said this on your podcast, there's no, you can't just pop open the book and start the campaign. You still have to prepare.
Yeah.
There's a lot of prep that goes into it.
Especially these big campaigns like Wizards has been putting out, like Curse of Strahd, you know.
Yes.
Because you kind of got to, you know, you at least want to read through the whole thing once first. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of, you got to be really solid on where the players are right now and what's going to happen next. And you also want to be fairly solid on the next few things after that, because you never know where they're going to go, and you want to be able to react and not have to be like, oh, stand by, I have to read the book for 15 minutes. You know,
it's like the ultimate in role-playing chess. Yeah. You have to be a few steps ahead, but looking at the Curse of Strahd book, it's a perfect example. There's so much detail in what the characters are going to be experiencing.
Yeah.
But it's both good and bad, because it can really give you the impression that you're limited. And if you go just by what's in the book, then that's actually dovetailing back into what we were talking about, or crossing back into what we were talking about. That's an easy way to get railroaded in. If it's not in the book, it doesn't happen.
Right.
Yeah. So it's, I think even with the difference between, you were talking about the different skill sets for homebrew versus these published campaigns. I think really when it boils down to it, a good DM would be able to take the published as not really a guide, but like as the beginning, and then be able to flesh out around that.
Yeah.
So that you have a more robust world around that.
Yeah. You know, I just had a thought while you were talking about that. You know what I think, and I'm sure someone's done this. You know what I think would be a cool way to approach publishing an adventure is, instead of doing like, this is an adventure that will take you from level 1 to 15 and like the whole adventure is there, that instead it's like the beginning, and it sets everything up. It gives you a bunch of NPCs and locations, and it kind of gets like a plot moving.
Right.
But then that's it. And it's up to you and your group to decide how it ends.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah, you just think.
Set up that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because
you set up all the plot points or the plot bunnies or whatever you want to call them, and just have no end to it.
Right. It's, you know, you decide how it ends. You know, because whatever we decide, chances are really good that that's not going to be the ending that's going to pan out for your group anyway. So why waste pages trying to tell you what one possible ending could be?
Right.
Yeah, I think.
So, you would use that book as like you would set the stage, right? You would you're coming in as a first level character or whatever, you would set the NPCs, the home locale and the region, everything that's going on. You would set the plots, I guess, for the adventure itself. And that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Do it.
Someone must have done this, right? This must be being done by somebody somewhere.
It's got to.
Yeah, I think running published campaigns, especially like a short adventure, isn't so bad. But like one of these campaigns, like Curse of Strahd or Storm King Sons or whatever, like I think they're difficult. And I think in some ways they're more difficult than running something homebrewed. And unless you have a photographic memory, if you have a photographic memory, it probably wouldn't be too bad. But there's just like Curse of Strahd and the Hintrine of Tomawakan are two perfect examples of this, where they're kind of sandboxy in a way, in that like especially Curse of Strahd, you have a lot of different things you could do. You have a lot of different places you could go. you have a few kind of pointers pointing you in a few directions, but really it's up to you where you go, when you go there, what order you do things. So as a DM preparing, unless you tell me what you're going to do next week, like I kind of have to be prepared to run any encounter or any dungeon from the entire campaign. And it's just like, you can't do that, you know? So like Hidden Shrine is like that too. There's so many different ways you could go. It's like, if I'm going to be prepared for this, I kind of have to be prepared, not just for the handful of encounters we'll get through tonight, but for the 15 possible encounters you could do tonight. You know what I mean? And it's too much to deal with. So with Hidden Shrine especially, I've tended to not really prepare for it much at all. I read through the next sections like beforehand, but that's about it, because I'm like, it's really a waste of time for me to do more than that, because I don't know which way you guys are going to go. And I could prep for room 23 and you guys go to room 36 instead, which I didn't prepare for. And, you know, I just wasted a bunch of time. And it's funny because, you know, I do this on YouTube and I'll get comments from people will be like, you know, I think the GM should really read the book before he runs this, because he obviously doesn't know what's going on. And it's like, yeah, you just don't get it. Like, unless you have a photographic memory, there's no way you can hold all of Curse of Strahd in your head or all of the Hidden Shrine. And be prepared for any possible thing the PCs do. Where if go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, and it's more difficult with a publication because you have written down what's supposed to come up next. Whereas with a homebrew or your own adventure, it's you can craft it. You know, you have an idea in your head because you created it. So it's part of your core already.
Yeah.
You guys are going to be traveling through this canyon, or you have the canyon to the left, you have the lake to the right. You know at least what's there, and you have that initial creativity in your brain. Whereas the published campaigns, it's written down, and if it's not as it's written, then there's always that fear of like, oh, I screwed it up, or I missed something, or
and I mean Wizards does a great job, and all these adventure writers do a great job, but they're very detailed. So if you do just kind of wing something or pull it out of your ass, chances are good you're going to get some of those details wrong or miss something. And it'll be something that actually matters later. So then you have to do damage control and be like, oh, I never told the PCs about the secret room here or whatever.
Yeah.
Where
on the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Where if it's something you came up with yourself, first of all, you're more likely to remember about the secret door or whatever. And second of all, if you forget, it's like, who cares? I'll just put the secret door somewhere else. It doesn't matter. Just move, you know? It, yeah. So, yeah, I think so. Having run a lot of published stuff in the last few years, I think they're actually harder. And that's one thing I'm looking forward to this next campaign doing completely homebrewed, is I think it'll be a lot easier to prepare it and to run it than running like Curse of Strahd or even Hidden Shrine. Turned out to be more challenging than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was just going to be this easy dungeon crawl, but
right.
It's so complex that it's, you know, it's more involved than I thought it was going to be.
It's quite the complex.
Yes, it is.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
I want to take a minute to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. It's because of the patrons that all the listeners of Game Master's Journey enjoy a bonus episode every month, as well as the monthly Game Master's Journey live stream. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my Tier 5 patron, Steve. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man. You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. So I have an idea. Since you're probably, hopefully, going to play in my next campaign.
Yeah.
Maybe I can tell you kind of what I'm thinking I'm going to tell the players as far as like character concepts. And then you can tell me if you think that's good enough.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So one thing, and the kind of the crappy thing about this is there's a lot of like reveals that I want to do. So it's a lot of, I want you to do this thing, but I'm not going to tell you why, you know,
okay.
Because yeah. If I tell you why, it's going to spoil a surprise. So just do it. And later you'll find out why it had to be this way. So the one thing is I want, characters who have like a heroic concept. I think the way I put it in the player's guide I'm writing is I want the kind of characters that would run into a burning building to save like someone's child or something.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's just for what I want to do, it's really important that I have those kinds of characters. So I think for the first time ever, I've said everybody has to be a good alignment. I'm not even going to accept like a lawful neutral character because I really want characters who will like work toward the common good kind of thing. You know, I don't want like a character like Steve's character in Shrine, like a roguish, selfish, you know, in it for myself kind of character, because right. There will come a point in the campaign where a player playing a character like that would be like, I don't think my character would be doing this anymore. Like, where's my motivation? So I need characters that their motivation is I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do, or I'm doing this because I want to make the world a better place, or I want to make life easier for the people in Alandria or something like that, you know?
Right. Right.
Like kind of altruistic kind of thing. So that's the probably the biggest limitation. So like, I think I said like, I'm probably not going to allow like the criminal or the charlatan background because they don't really fit that.
Okay.
But a possibility could be if someone wanted to do like a redemption arc, like a Han Solo kind of thing, like you start out like you're this selfish rogue, but fairly early in the campaign, you maybe because you're adventuring with these other heroic people, they like inspire you and you decide that you want to be something more, you know, kind of thing. Like that right. could be cool, but there will be a point in the campaign where it's like, okay, at this point you kind of have to be a heroic character for it to really make sense.
So would it be too simplistic to simply say the limitation for the character is that it would have to be a good alignment? Can it be chaotic good as well, or is it just chaotic? Or
yeah, just any good alignment. Yeah.
Okay. So would it be enough to say for this particular campaign, for this setting, the only requisite or prerequisite for the character building is that it has to be of this alignment, and what was the other?
No charlatans or criminals.
Yeah, and with these backgrounds, yeah. Would that be too vague? Do you think, or without giving away any ideas about the story itself?
Yeah, I don't think so. But I mean, I'm comfortable telling people what I just told you. You know,
cool.
I mean, obviously, this is going to be on a podcast, so they're all going to listen to it.
Forget what you just heard.
Because I do like if someone wanted to do the redemption thing, I think that could be cool. Like maybe because it's like, just because I have a criminal background doesn't mean that's who I have to be forever, right? Like people can change.
Right.
And
right.
It could be cool to play a character who used to be a criminal or, you know, a charlatan or a con artist or something like that. And for whatever reason, they don't do that anymore.
Or know? A wrongly accused criminal.
Yeah, that would be cool. Okay, so that's the one big thing. The other big thing is and this flies in the face of everything I'm going to be preaching about the setting, but I actually want every character to have, they don't necessarily have to have a quote patron deity, but I want every character to have one of the deities that they have some kind of special connection to. It could be that they have an actual bona fide patron deity, or it could just be maybe you think this God has blessed you in the past. Maybe you think for some reason this God like looks on you with favor, or maybe just your own personal ideals and goals seem to align really well with what this God is about. Kind of
interesting.
Thing. And okay. I want every character, every God that each character chooses to be a different God. I don't want two characters choosing the same God.
Right. Huh.
Yeah. And that's another thing that I can't tell you why.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that just makes me want to know why. That's because that's kind of a specific thing.
Yeah. So, okay, this is a total tangent, but I'm really excited about this because I just finally figured this out last night. So let me tell you about why it like the patron deity thing is like what that's about. So
okay.
A big problem I have with D&D as it's presented is I really feel like they're, how can I say this without getting in trouble? I don't feel like it presents polytheism correctly, because D&D settings like Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms, and just what we're told in the core books, they tell us, you know, this is a polytheistic setting. There are multiple gods. Everybody believes in all the gods, like they know they're real kind of thing. But then they turn around and tell you about having a patron deity and this idea that like you choose one god that's like, that's my god, that's my bro, you know, like I'm all about this one god, which in a polytheistic world, like that doesn't even make any sense. Like that's not the way polytheism works. And it's really just someone who was brought up with a monotheistic worldview, kind of like wanting to throw polytheism into the game, but not seeming to really understand what it is or how it works, and kind of viewing it through this distorted, like monotheistic view. Like, well, obviously there's all these gods, but obviously you would pick one, right? It's your god, because that's the way it has to be, right? And it's like, well, no,
true.
That's not. So I've wrestled with this a lot, and this is why I wanted to do the mystery cult thing, was because I wanted Primordia to really be polytheistic, and I wanted the idea of I'm going to choose one of the gods and really devote myself to that god. Like those people are like rare, like they're free. Like most people would never do that, and. So I finally kind of worked it all out, like how I'm going to do this. And, you know, the patron deity thing is really the big problem, because it doesn't really fit with polytheism. And like, for instance, in the Forgotten Realms, when you die, you go, your soul goes to the plane of your patron deity, you know,
right.
Which doesn't make sense, because most people wouldn't have patron deities. If you don't have a patron deity, then your soul goes to the plane that matches your alignment, right? Because each plane is the manifestation of an alignment in like the core D&D or whatever. So I just like, to me, that doesn't make sense, because I'm like, okay, in Primordia, I have 18 gods. And my idea is that everybody worships all the gods. So when I die, I'm going to go to 18 different planes, you know, like, you know, that doesn't make sense. So I thought about it, and what I finally decided was that the patron deity thing just is like, that's an aberration, someone that has a patron deity. And the reason is that the gods are jealous, right? And it really comes down to each god's domain or their portfolio. So let's take like the god of war, for example. So the god of war, Kalis, his domain, his portfolio is war and anything that has to do with war. So let's say you have this character who's a young man or a young woman who's a soldier and marching off to battle for the first time. If that person didn't give some kind of honor to Kalis, like an offering or a prayer or something, there's a very real chance that that person would offend the god of war, or at least that's what people would believe, because going to war is... that's in his portfolio. And so it's like plagiarizing, you know, it's like if you're going to quote a source, you have to give a reference kind of thing. Like you have to say, I got this quote from this book, right? Otherwise it's plagiarizing. It's that kind of idea. It's like, if I'm going to do something that involves a domain of one of the gods, I have to honor that god as I do so, or I risk that god getting pissed off and
okay.
taking sure. vengeance against me. So
if that soldier didn't give thanks or something to Kalus before going to battle, then he, you know, you're basically inviting a horrible death in the battle because Kalus is not going to be happy. And at the very least, he's not going to protect you or help you out at all. And he might even like make things go against you because he wants to make an example of you or whatever. So the idea is in Primordia, people honor all the gods and they honor them anytime they do something that involves that god's portfolio. So God of War, anytime you fight in a duel or anytime you go to battle or anything like that, you would be thinking about the God of War and maybe make an offering or make a prayer or say every kill in this battle I dedicate to Kalus or something like that. Right.
Right. Right.
And so the gods are very jealous. And I see it like when you worship a god, whether it's giving an offering or praying or whatever you're doing, you're like sending energy to that god. And that energy is like their food. It's like
it gives them power.
Right. And so the gods know, like a given, like the God of War knows who's sending him energy, how much they're sending him. And he also knows how much he's receiving from you compared to how much you're giving to the other gods.
Oh.
And so the way the people of Primordia look at it is they try to honor all of the gods as equally as humanly possible, because what they don't want is for one of the gods, say Kalus, to say, you know what, you're honoring this other god more than me. Hmm. And I don't like that. So I'm coming after you, kind of thing. So the best way to avoid the gods noticing you in a bad way is to honor them all equally. So someone who says, I'm going to follow Kalus above and beyond all gods, he's my patron deity, you know, they're kind of like thumbing their nose at all 17 other gods.
Right.
And so they run the risk that all those other gods, especially any gods that are directly opposed to Kalus or don't like Kalus, are going to be offended and not like that. And I think that someone like a cleric or a paladin or a druid will do that and can do that because their idea is, well, Kalus is going to protect me. Since I'm a cleric of Kalus, he's going to protect me from the other gods. And I don't have to worry so much about the fact that the other gods aren't going to be happy that I'm, for the most part, only worshiping Kalus, or I'm worshiping him a lot more than the other gods.
Right. Right.
But
that makes sense.
Yeah. But you know, you don't know if he'll actually do that or not, or maybe someone thinks, I might be doomed, but I believe what I'm doing is so important that I'm willing to take this risk of offending the other gods to follow this one god or whatever. But I think it's something that your average person would never dream of doing. It'd just be like you're tempting fate. Kind of like why the benefits you're going to get from that one god are not going to outweigh the downsides you're going to get from the other 17. So yeah, that, you know, and as far as like the afterlife, my outer planes aren't going to have alignments. They're not going to have anything to do with alignment. And the afterlife is actually, for the most part, the same for everybody. And it doesn't have anything to do with the gods. So it's like the gods are kind of don't really have it. The afterlife is all about how you live your life and the things that you do as far as what happens to you. And everybody has different beliefs as far as what the afterlife is like and what a good life is and blah, 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 blah. But right. But it's not this idea of, you know, I'm going to go live with one of the gods. You're going to go to this special place that's like the heaven of Primordia, but it's not associated with any one of the gods. So if you like, say you're a cleric of Kalus, the god of war, and you're really devout, it's possible when you die, he might take you and make you into an angel or something like that. But that's like the exception. Like most people just go to this afterlife.
Right. Right.
Kind of thing. And in that way, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. So like the greater heroes, when they die, so something like the Valkyrie would, the story of the Valkyrie would happen where the gods kind of recruit the fallen for their own purposes. Not the Valkyrie. Who am I thinking of? The Ironhjarr. The after Ragnarok. I'm sorry, I'm falling into Norse mythology.
That's all right.
But, But basically the fallen heroes would rise as like the army of these gods. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, something like that could happen. I know I've asked you this before. Have you read The Wheel of Time?
No.
Oh, because there's
yes, you have, and no, I haven't.
Yeah. So there's something exactly like what you're talking about in that. It's called the Horn of Valir, and it's like a magic item. And great heroes, when they die, are bound to the horn, and whoever blows the horn, like all these heroes from ages past, come back,
yeah, okay,
and fight for them.
Sure.
So actually a lot of this actually is inspired by the Wheel of Time and the various real world stuff that inspired that. So most people in Primordia actually believe in reincarnation.
Okay.
And so people are constantly reborn. And so the afterlife is really a place where you go and rest until your next birth. So cool. So when you die, you go to this other plane and you stay there for a while. And if you had a good life, it's a fairly pleasant experience. If you had a bad life, it could be a very unpleasant experience. But then after so much time, you're reborn back into the world. And so I've even thought about like how that's going to affect resurrection. So, you know, once someone's been reborn, you can't resurrect them because... You know, or at least that's
because you're there in a body.
Yeah. Or at least that's what's believed. Ooh. Might have to try it and see what happens. But I mean, usually the time you spend between lives is more than a human lifetime. Like
I was going to say, is there a statute of limitations on reviving?
Yeah, it's probably like, you know, it could be decades or hundreds of years because in this other realm, like time is kind of meaningless.
Right.
And this other realm is, I don't know. Fuck it. I'm like, how much do I want to spoil?
No, don't spoil too much.
So it's kind of like its own plane, basically, this place that people go when they die. And it's cool. It's not specifically the place where any of the gods live. It's not where any of the gods are. It's its own place. The gods have their own little domains in the outer planes.
Okay.
So the only time someone goes to live with a particular god is if they're really devoted to that god and that god decides, hey, I can use you, kind of thing.
Right.
And then they might become some kind of an angel or something like that. So in this way, like I don't have to worry about like the planes having alignments and like I don't see my deities as really having alignments. I see them as being kind of beyond the concept of alignment. Which is a pretty big, you know, like in D&D, like alignment is this like cosmic reality, right? Like the outer planes are manifestations of the different alignments. And it's like this fundamental building block of the universe where, you know, in my world, it's just human morality. Like that's all it is. It's not like the atom. It's not a fundamental building block of the universe. So the planes don't have alignments. The gods don't have alignments, you know, because I mean, really what's evil? It's when someone does something you don't like. Right. So, you know, a god destroying a city. Yeah. People would say, oh, that god did something evil. But it's like the way I think about it is like somebody killing a bunch of ants. Would you say that person is evil because they just wiped out 1,000 ants? It's like, well, no, it's like, who cares? They're ants, you know? And that's like what we are to the gods. Now, if someone just spent a lot of their time just killing as many ants as possible, you might start to think there's something wrong with that person. Like
there's something else going on. Yeah.
Right. Right. But that's more a thing of you're spending way too much time doing this kind of twisted thing that doesn't really matter. What's wrong with you? As opposed to, oh, you're so evil because you're trying to kill all the ants, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. It begs the question, is there true, oh man, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole. Is there any true evil from the natural perspective, right? Or is it something like the evil men do, to quote Iron Maiden? It's hard. I always have had a difficult time with when gaming, throwing in the alignment and having people play off of it, because some of the best story arcs come from when they fall away from the alignment, like when good people do horrible things,
yeah,
or when bad people like you were saying earlier, redeem themselves. They do something particularly good and heroic.
Yeah.
Really makes for a great story. And not just in gaming, but in books and movies and everything. That's like it's the Han Solo, right?
Right. Yeah. Or like Game of Thrones. I mean, have fun assigning alignments to any of those characters. Oh, jeez. You know?
Yeah, no.
You'd have to on a scene-by-scene basis.
In an episode. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
In this scene, Jaime Lannister is lawful good. In this scene, he's lawful evil. In this scene, he's chaotic neutral.
Yeah, really tough to dissect that crew.
Yeah, I think alignment is great as like a shorthand for morality, like sure. Like especially for me as a DM to look at a monster and say, okay, this monster is chaotic evil. Like it in two words, I have a pretty good sense of like how I'm going to role play it, you know. Yeah. But as far as like building game mechanics around it and well, all that, I don't think it works so well.
I agree completely. And yeah, setting alignments to or setting planes to specific alignments and setting you know, even artifacts, that sort of thing, gets a little wishy-washy. But it's it can be used as, if it's used loosely, alignments can be used as a good gut check for the players too. Looking at you're role playing the character, you're going through the scenarios and the actions and throughout the campaign, something specific happens and you as a person want to do it this way, but you know, looking at that paper, it's like, well, actually I'm chaotic neutral. Would I really do it this way? And yeah. how would that, it's just like a quick gut check. It doesn't have to define the character.
That's a really good point. And it can help you play a character who's different from yourself. Like
totally.
Yeah. Like maybe in the real world, if I were to give myself an alignment, I don't know, let's say it's chaotic good. Right. But this character I'm playing is lawful good.
Right.
So when I make decisions like that, I can be like, well, I would do this, but my character is more lawful than I am.
Right.
So he's more concerned about what the law is, where I'd just be concerned about what do I think is right? Who gives a shit what the law is, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Or sometimes if I'm playing, right. Yeah. Or if I'm playing like a lawful evil character, you know, I can be like, well, this is what I would do, but what would a lawful evil character do?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's a good point.
It just kind of helps you steer when you're playing the game. That's all.
Yeah. But the whole, like the planes having alignment thing is always bother me.
It doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of fans of Planescape out there and I really want to like Planescape and I like the idea of adventuring in the planes, but I don't really like Planescape because it's so wrapped around this idea of alignment and they take it even farther where there's these philosophical groups representing the different alignments and they like, you know, are constantly in conflict with one another. And it just doesn't fit what I see in the world around me happening around me. I just don't see that. It's hard enough to see good and evil in the world, much rather, you know, lawful good versus neutral good. And, you know, like lawful evil versus neutral evil. It's like, it's just, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, and like one thing I wonder about is like, okay, let's say I live in one of these worlds and let's say I'm neutral good and my wife is lawful good. So when we die, we're going to go to completely different afterlives and never see each other again, just because our alignments are slightly different, even though we, you know, lived in the same culture and blah, 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 blah. Like it just and who would want to believe that? Who would want to live in a culture and believe that when you die, you're never going to see your loved ones again, unless they had the same patron deity as you and they had the same alignment as you, you know, like the whole idea of an afterlife is, you know, I'll see my loved ones again. And, you know, like people comfort themselves with that. So how comforting would it be if it's like, well, in the afterlife, I never will see my loved ones again.
Yeah. Like, oh, well, I guess this is it. Yeah. And from the perspective of the gods in gaming, it doesn't seem like that's something that they would themselves want to promote, because right. it would ultimately lead to people moving away from their own influence.
Yeah, that's a good point. So
it's not in their best interest.
Yeah. So let's see. Wow, we went on a huge tangent. So
I'm trying so hard not to fall into philosophy.
Yeah. So so it's kind of weird, you know, I say all this and I'm like, you know, 99.9% of people in Primordia do not have a patron deity. And in fact, I'm fairly comfortable saying that for the most part, the only people who will have patron deities are player characters. And usually, you know, even among player characters, it's going to tend to be like your clerics and your druids and your paladins. And other than that, most player characters won't. But yet for this particular campaign, I want everybody that it doesn't have to be a patron deity, but just a deity that maybe, I don't know, like, influenced them. Right. Like yeah. If it's a god of war, maybe you were in a battle and you should have died and somehow by luck, like you survived and you see that as the god of war was with you for some reason. And so now you're right. The god of war is kind of special to you now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I think one thing like that a lot of times as GMs we fail at when it comes to like religion in D&D is like showing it in the world other than just clerics and stuff like that. So right. I've really been trying to think about like how it affects the culture. And one thing I was thinking about is, you know, each god has a portfolio, which is what they kind of are over. And the idea is that the gods aren't omniscient, which is to say they don't know everything about everything. But when it comes to their portfolio, they're pretty much omniscient. So anytime you're doing anything that at all touches on the war portfolio, the god of war knows what's going on.
Oh, you know, I see.
He doesn't know everything you do, but or the goddess of marriage knows when you cheat on your wife. You know, that kind of thing. And so one thing I thought of is when things happen that like us in our world, we would say, oh, that was luck or serendipity or chance or coincidence. In Primordia, people will ascribe it to one of the gods. And no one really knows like if a god is really at work in this situation or not. And if so, which god? Like that's beyond mortals to know. But people will think that they know, you know, based on, well, what portfolio is involved here, you know? So like the guy that cheats on his wife and as he's sneaking back home, he like trips and breaks his neck, you know, someone might say, oh, well, that was the work of the goddess of home, family, and marriage who didn't like what he was doing and so punished him. Instead of saying, oh, that was bad luck or whatever, they see one of the gods as being involved in that.
Right.
And so you, anytime you're doing something that would involve one of the gods or might involve one of the gods, you're either praying to them in the hopes that they will help you do what you're trying to do, or you're praying to them in the hopes that they just won't get in your way and interfere with what you're doing. And the idea is that people, for the most part, when people make offerings to the god, it's more out of a sense of fear and obligation than it is that they're hoping for like a blessing. It's usually only in dire circumstances or when they're really desperate that people will actually ask the gods for favors. Cause it's more like we'd really rather just avoid the notice of the gods and let the gods kind of do their own thing and leave us alone. And so we'll do what we can to avoid offending them, but we don't really want to call attention to ourselves.
That makes sense.
But you know,
that works well with the whole paying tribute to all of them at once or paying, you know, not giving too much attention to any particular one.
Right. So let's say I'm a parent and my kid is like really, really sick and I'm afraid they might die. Like I might pray to, you know, a god like the god of healing to heal my child and ask, you know, for something in that, because it's like it's really important and like I don't care the consequences at that point. But I would probably also, maybe not at that moment, but later, like let's say that my kid gets better and is okay. Then I might go and give offerings to say the god of death so that the god of death isn't angry because, you know, maybe the god of death really wanted my kid or something. Or at the very least, I gave this huge offering to the god of healing. So I want to square things up with the god of death so that we're cool. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
and all the other gods while I'm at it, you know?
Right, right.
Which is why this church, whatever it's going to be called, is kind of important, because their whole thing is, hey, we intercede with all the gods for you. And if you just give your money to the church every week, we'll take care of it and you don't have to worry about it. Of course, it's probably all BS. They're really spending that money on their private yachts and stuff, but you know, whatever. I don't want to sound too cynical.
Not yet. Very good. That sounds cool.
So I'm trying to think what other guidelines. I mean, I have more specific guidelines. Like, for instance, a ranger would be an awesome character to play in this, because there's going to be lots of wilderness exploration. But yeah, that's the big things, like good aligned heroic character. You need to have a deity that you're especially cool with, and everybody needs different deities. And I think that's really it. Other than that,
that's not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty open.
And no gnomes.
And yeah, no gnomes and no stout halflings. But there are genasi and various types of Azamar and elves with wings. So you can be a flying character if you want.
I will greatly give up for the gnome for those.
Yeah. So
absolutely. Again, I've never played a gnome. I don't know why I'm hung up on that, but
because they're really short. Who wants to play someone that's 3 feet tall? I don't.
Oh.
and at least halflings are like, I don't know. Honestly, I think the only reason people play halflings is because of Lord of the Rings. I think if Lord of the Rings didn't exist, no one would play halflings either. But at least they're really good at being like thieves.
True.
You know,
stereotypically.
Yeah, it's like, well, gnomes make really good wizards, but then so do elves and so do humans. And, you know, it's like, you don't have to be a gnome to be a really good wizard, you know?
Yeah.
So you don't want to play a gnome just for that, just to be a wizard. It's not really necessary.
No, not at all.
So
no, that's all.
So do you think that's enough guidance? I mean, I guess it's kind of hard to say, but
it's difficult to say, but as long as the rest is open and there's nothing else that you want to hold people back from playing anything that might be disruptive to the story itself. No, I think that all sounds good. That's a strong, strong beginning.
Yeah. The only other thing is, I want people to, as a party, think about how different roles are covered, because the kind of the idea of how this campaign starts, it's a very kind of Leverage or Ocean's 11 kind of thing where a member of the guild needs a job done and chooses people from the city who are not yet in the guild, but who have certain skills that would make them good as adventurers, and kind of puts together this dream team of people who are not yet adventurers, but are each capable in their own chosen, whatever it is that they do to do this thing, because it's something that they don't want to use a full adventuring team of the guild for. Like, it's not quite that important, but it's important enough. They don't want to just send anybody to do it either. Like, they want it to happen. You know, they want it to be a success. So because of that, it's like to have a party that, you know, didn't, like, for instance, to have a party with no one has the survival skill wouldn't make sense, because that's something that, like, you guys would have to have. And this person kind of forming this group would never form a group without, it'd be like doing Ocean's 11 and you don't have a grifter. It's like, you wouldn't do that. You know, you got to have a grifter, right? But kind of what's interesting is when I started thinking about the roles as I saw them that I thought needed to be filled, I started out thinking it was going to be a class thing, or like the, you know, we need tank, heals, and DPS kind of thing.
Right, sure.
But what it really ended up being was, it was really more about the skills. It really boiled down to, we need someone with survival. We need someone with arcana. We need someone with stealth.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like the roles are really more based on the skills. So you could fill that role by through your class or even through your background, you know, 'cause like a background could give you, you know, survival. And then you can fill that role kind of thing. So I do have in the player's guide I made, I have a section on the different roles, and like your group as a whole should probably have these covered, you know, kind of thing.
Interesting. That's actually kind of cool, because it's both as a DM and as a player, I kind of feel like the skills are underappreciated. They're or at least I I tend to like wash over them very easily. You roll those all the time, yeah. And yet there's not an outward or an overt need for a specific for a particular set of skills that is needed for the party. It's always, you know, anybody can try it. You might not be great at it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, as you advance in level, that disparity grows as your proficiency bonus gets bigger. You know, at first level, not being trained in a skill, it's like, well, it's only a +2 difference, you know, versus someone who is. But as you get higher level, like, it's kind of like, well, if you're trained in this skill, you have a good chance of succeeding. If you're not trained, unless you have a really high attribute, you probably don't have a very good chance.
Right.
So some of the roles I came up with, well, the first one, the obvious one, is healing. So that one, I mean, I tied it to the medicine skill, but that one is really, I mean, it's not so much a skill. It's, you know, being able to, I don't even see it so much as healing hit points, because, you know, you have long rest and short rest. You can get potions. I think you need a healer really for removing conditions.
Poison.
Yeah. Curse, yeah. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you could do that with a cleric. They get the restoration spells. A bard does. Paladins can remove disease with lay on hands. And I think as they go up level, they can remove more conditions with lay on hands.
Oh.
And that's one that we could probably get from like a magic item. And I actually, and I'll explain this to people when we start doing character creation, but if there is something missing in the party, like for instance, healing, as long as it's not so blatant that it's like, there's no way your sponsor would have put this party together with this glaring deficiency. As long as it's not that bad, like I have ways that I can compensate for, like you don't have a full blown healer. Like I have ways that I can mitigate that. That I can't tell you about. But
dang it.
One of the big roles though is survival. So that's a survival skill, and also the nature skill, being able to navigate, not get lost, find food and water, stuff like that. Stealth is actually, this is actually something I should tell you, because this might affect your character you're thinking about.
Yeah.
Is I see stealth as being important to everybody. And although I don't think everybody in the group necessarily has to be proficient in stealth, I do think people should probably avoid having disadvantage on stealth, which is like your heavy armor, right? If you're wearing heavy armor.
It was going to be my first attempt at a tank. I still might find a way around it or not. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's, I believe mithril armor.
True.
Is a way around that. And there's probably other ways, but yeah, I mean, I kind of go back and forth on this, because a lot of times in fifth edition, they use the group stealth check, where everybody makes a check, and as long as half of the PCs make it, you're okay. And the idea is that somehow the rest of you are helping out the clumsy loud person.
Yeah.
And I think that I'll use that when I can, but I also think that there will be times when it's going to be like, no, we are going to go by everybody's role. And if one person doesn't roll high enough, like the thing hears you kind of thing, you know?
Sure.
So that's the one that I feel like everybody should at least think about. And at least if you're going to wear heavy armor and have disadvantage, like realize that this could be a huge liability to you and the group. And maybe start saving for that mithril armor now.
Right. Isn't there, maybe I'm thinking of a different system, but is there we can talk about it offline. But I thought there were other mechanics.
There probably are, like a feat, like, maybe, or.
Yeah, like a feat or moving slower, or I can't remember. I think that one comes from a different game. But
Yeah.
Anyway,
you know what? I'm trying to think. I think with the overland travel, I know if you move at a fast pace, you get disadvantage, I think. Or no, yeah. No, it's if you're moving slow, you can move stealthily. That's what it is.
Okay.
That's
okay.
What I'm thinking of. Another role is Arcana, the Arcana skill. That's going to be useful for all kinds of stuff. And also, if you encounter any rifts, being able to figure out where the rift is going and figure out if you can seal it or not. And I'm going to come up with like spells that you use to like seal rifts.
Oh, cool.
Another role is diplomacy. So that would be persuasion or intimidation, depending which way you want to go. Insight, maybe deception. So like your face, right? Like someone's got to do that. Perception. You want to have at least one person that's good at perception. Fighting. I guess that's another one that everybody's going to be doing. And then religion. So yeah, these all, with the exception of healing and fighting, these all pretty directly map to a skill as opposed to necessarily a class. Although I did map fighting to athletics, because it can be nice to have someone that's good at athletics in case you need to climb or swim or something like
jump.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
At least definitely. Have one person in the group that can do it. Cause I've had groups where nobody could do athletics and it's like, well, crap, what do we do now? Nobody can climb this thing.
Yeah. I've had jumping issues, in my characters in the past, or my strength just isn't enough to get across. Jumping whatever it is issues. We're trying to jump. In fact, I think in one adventure I actually fell through. I missed it by like 2 feet. I fell into a pit.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, it did. It wasn't fun.
I hate it when that happens. Well, I feel like I've been really hogging this conversation. What do you want to talk about today, Brett?
Oh, geez, I don't know. I'm just having a good time. Have you ever read the, well, I'm assuming you have because you're going through the pages now, but have you ever read the DM's guide front to back?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah. Yeah. I really love that book. I actually enjoyed reading it pretty much front to back. I don't think I read like all the magic items, but other than that, I think I pretty much did read it front to back.
I think there are still parts of, in your podcast, you're coming up with, you're discussing things that I must have just skimmed over.
Yeah. I'm still in chapter one.
I love the book. I know you are. I know.
At this rate, I just hope I finish it before I die, you know?
No, I love all the stuff that they put in here, but yeah. I've used it as kind of a guide. Literally Dungeon Master's guide. I look up the stuff that I need at the time because I know I'm not going to remember all of it.
Right.
And so by doing that, I feel like I've skimmed over so much. That's really probably not something a DM should admit, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know that those books are intended to be read cover to cover. They're more like reference books, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You look up what you need when you need it kind of thing. But I tell you, when I did the Player's Handbook episodes, I found so much stuff when I was making those that I'd either forgotten about or never noticed or had been remembering wrong or doing wrong. And and it's kind of nice because now I feel like it's kind of like what Jeremy Crawford says. Like, I don't know everything that's in the Player's Handbook, but for the most part, I know where everything is. So right. When I have a question, I know where to find the answer, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
That's a benefit. Definitely a benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's not always where you think it's going to be, you know, I mean, they're laid out pretty well, but not, you know, not perfectly. So,
well, it's a lot of information that cross references each other too. So it's hard to lay out the ideal because everybody's ideal is going to be different. But yeah, it always seems to throw off every time when I'm DMing, every time I have to pause to look something up, it always throws me off and pulls me out of the story. And I don't like doing that.
Yeah.
But
yeah, as you run more, it happens less and less, I think.
True.
I know when I first started running 5th edition, like we were stopping to look stuff up all the time. It was nuts. And yeah, I, you know, It's funny now that I think about it. I don't really do a whole lot of rulings on the fly in fifth edition. I usually either remember what the actual rule is, or I know well enough where to find it that I feel like I can find it quick enough that I can just look it up real quick. And I don't really remember much at all, just being like, oh, I'll just do it this way and figure it out later. And in third edition, I did that all the time. And it is like the first part of every session was like, okay, here are the things I did on the fly last week that I since looked up and learned were wrong. And this is how we're going to do it from now on. And I would have to decide, am I going to do it the way the book does it? Or am I going to do it the way I did it last week and let everybody know? And
right. Did I just house rule it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really dig that about fifth edition. Like, it's just, it's so simple. It's
yeah.
Like you
yeah,
can really kind of grasp it, you know?
It allows you to tell the story without getting too bogged down.
Yeah.
That's what I love the most about that. And the stories I hear about fourth edition.
Yeah.
So it's all good.
Yeah. Yeah. So I dig it. I got to get you guys to try Numenera sometime.
Yeah, I'm interested. I know absolutely nothing about it. So
yeah, it's a lot of fun. I like the setting a lot more than I like the system, but the system's all right. It like D&D is very simple and something that you can just kind of internalize it and not hardly ever have to look anything up. In that way, it's even more simple than D&D, I think.
Oh wow.
So that's cool. But I love the setting. It's a lot of fun. And it's very much influenced a lot of what I'm doing with Primordia.
Oh, cool.
But it's funny, you know, when I first got into Numenera, I thought it was like this super unique thing that I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. And then I found out that science fantasy was this whole genre that I never even knew about. And read like Gene Wolfe and was like, okay, so Numenera isn't really that super unique. Like there's been other stuff like this before, but it was new to me. And then after that, coming back to D&D with fifth edition and realizing that, yeah, this kind of thing's also kind of always been part of D&D as well. You know, this kind of blending with science fiction a bit, you know,
right?
Like
right.
Some of the really old adventures, like one of them, I can't remember which one now, involved like a spaceship crashed in a mountain.
Oh,
you know, like one of the old adventures, like either first edition or even before first edition.
Oh wow!
So it's kind of always been there. It's just how much a given setting or DM wants to kind of draw on that or not.
Sure.
So, and that's one thing I really like about the Wheel of Time too. Is it's definitely fantasy, but the way the magic works and the way things are explained kind of has this sci-fi flair to it. Like it kind of makes more sense than fantasy usually does. There's a lot less of the hand waving, like it works cause magic, you know, it's like everything is very, it works cause of this, 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 and this, and this is what the magic can do. This is what the magic can't do. It's not like Gandalf where the magic can do whatever Tolkien wants it to do.
It's because it's magic. It named that for a reason.
That's right. So, yeah. So I can't believe you've never read those books. Are you just going to wait for the TV show or are you going to read them?
At this point, I might as well. No, it's every time I go to pick one up, it's just the size of it. I'm like,
they are doorstops.
Next time. Yeah. Maybe next time. And so, yeah, I just never picked it up.
Yeah, they are doorstops. And I don't know. I feel like they'd be harder for someone to get into now than they would have been 10 or 15 years ago.
Because, well, how many are there now?
I think the total, not counting the prequel, is 14, I think.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I say that is because of the writing style and just the writing style that you see in the popular fantasy has changed over the years. And now, you know, the style now is a lot less description and more just dialogue and what happens and very little or sometimes no description.
True.
Where these books are heavy, heavy description. Like he'll spend a page or two just telling you what everybody in the room is wearing, what they look like, what the room looks like, what the architecture's like, what their clothes are like, just really rich detail, but it's just a very different kind of pacing than a lot of the more modern stuff. So I could see people that are really into fantasy these days and what's coming out now having a harder time getting into it, just because it's like, wow, this just seems like a lot of words and a lot of descriptions and a lot of, you know, what everybody's clothes look like. Clean.
Yeah.
A lot of navel gazing. And, but it's cool because you can see everything vividly in your head. Like, you know exactly what people look like. You know exactly, like when you go to a different country, you know exactly how their fashions are different than the other places you've been, and how their clothes are really weird. Because these guys wear veils over their face, and you know, these guys' clothes are very reminiscent of feudal Japan, and blah, 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 blah. And so it's cool in that way. And when they make the TV show, you know, hopefully they use that, you know, and recreate it instead of like, we're going to do our own thing, you know, because it's all there. Like,
right.
Yeah. Like the wardrobe person, man, it, you know, you just got to do it. Like, it's all there. What it's supposed to look like, you know? So I think, what was it? Well, this wasn't fantasy. This was sci-fi. Old Man's War. Is that Scalzi? I think. But anyway, that book, like, he never described anything.
Oh.
You know, I think as far as the main character, we got hair and eye color and gender, and that was about it. And as far as like the places that you went and the things you saw, like, he hardly ever described anything. It was a good book. It was well written. And I think if I weren't a writer myself, I probably wouldn't have even noticed that he never described anything. Like, I'm like, I don't even know what these spaceships look like, you know? But yeah, it's just, you know, I think overall it's probably a better way to write if you want as many people as possible to get into what you're doing.
Right. You know? To see what you're seeing.
Yeah. Because you're just focusing on the dialogue and what's happening, you know? So it's very snappy, you know?
The other way, yeah. Yep.
Almost like reading a screenplay, probably.
Probably, you know? Very quick.
Yeah.
Quick to the points. Yeah, I don't know. It's too much description kind of lulls me to sleep sometimes. So, but yeah. Then not enough description.
That's a great word. Description. I like it.
Oh, wow. I wonder where that came from. Too much description. Not enough description pulls me out of the story just as easily because I can't figure out what's going on. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. Got to find that middle ground. And, it, you know, to kind of bring it home, it's the same thing like when you're running a game, right? Like,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You don't want to, and I think you've said this before, you don't want to start off with, or at any time, you don't want to have to, in order to get your point across, hand a manuscript to your players and right. say, okay, to understand what's going on, you got to get through this first.
Yeah. Or maybe even worse, read a manuscript to your player.
Oh, no, I don't like my own voice. I'm not going to put it through.
Yeah.
I'm not going to force anybody else to listen to it for that long.
It's but like,
yeah, it's.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, even the published stuff, like for instance, Curse of Strahd, some of the read aloud text in there is just way too long. And there you're only talking about maybe two or three paragraphs, but it's still too long. So, you know, if as a GM, you're going to sit here and write three pages typed that you're going to read to your players, like you might not want to do that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Every page, it seems like, or every page I open to in it. I mean, it's great description.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really flavorful.
It is.
And you start to feel, if you do read all that, you start to feel pretentious and like you're being way too purple. You know, it's just like,
well, and my problem with doing that is there's a point where it gets to a point where you can tell when you're being read to, and you can tell when the story is developing naturally.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. But then, you know, like we were just saying with books, you know, you don't want to go too far the other way too and not give enough description, especially if you're doing theater of the mind and then you have people confused about what's right. going on and where everybody is and all that good stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
One of these days I'd like to talk to you about that because I had an experience that you were part of. with Theater of the Mind.
Okay.
Didn't go quite as well as I had hoped.
Was that when you were running it?
Yeah. Right. I feel like, and I think a lot of it has to do with the players.
Yeah.
And me, my inability to describe things as we go. And we're all so used to having maps, even if it was just like a whiteboard when we were playing, you know, in the living room, something to use as a point of reference. Yeah. And so trying it without, it just didn't seem to work as well. And I don't know if it's because, well, I think it was a number of things. I think it was something new that I hadn't done before and that I was trying out that threw everybody off because nobody was expecting to do it. And we got into a particular encounter that pretty much required some sort of element of where everybody was, you know, in association. And so I don't know. So my experience didn't go all that great as a DM. I don't feel like it did. It sounded afterward like everybody seemed okay with it, but it didn't feel like it went well.
Well, I'm remembering an instance from your campaign. I don't know if this is the time you're talking about, but my perception of it was I thought it was fine. Like we got into a combat, I think it was, and we were, you know, you didn't have a map or whatever. We were just doing it Theater of the Mind, and you were describing what's going on, and I was fine. And but then one of the other players, it was like there's like one thing that they didn't understand, and they were just like, I can't do this, we got to have a map, you know. It was like they just as soon as there's one thing they needed a clarification on, they just threw up their hands and they're like, I can't do this, I need a map. I think that's literally what he said. I can't remember which one it was, but I think it was more a thing of the players not being used to that,
and maybe
not being willing to give it a shot, than it was that you weren't describing things enough or whatever.
Well, and I think not even necessarily giving it a shot, but it was pulling them out of it, right? It was pulling them out of the action of the encounter where they were having a hard time understanding, or not understanding, but I was having a hard time describing to them what was going on, where they didn't have a visual in their head because of that. And okay. So the frustration kicked in. From my perspective, it was entirely my fault because I wasn't describing it to the detail that they're used to.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is Theater of the Mind play is it's just different. And it's, you know, just like kind of comparing running a published adventure versus homebrew, it's like a different skill set in some ways.
And, true. Very
and,
true.
And if you only use maps and minis and you haven't played that way before, you haven't played that way very much, then, you know, you don't really know how it works, you know, and a big part of it is kind of the going back and forth. Like the DM says, you know, this is what you see. And then you ask like clarifying questions like, well, how far away is this guy from me? Or can I get line of sight to this guy or whatever? And so I think part of it is just the, you know, learning how to play that way as a group. And, you know, like something I've noticed with Theater of the Mind is, I guess if I had one piece of advice to give players is when you're going to ask the DM a question, think about what you really want to know. Because a lot of times a player will ask me, how far away is this character from me? Which kind of slows things down because I'm like, I don't know. I don't think that way. Like, I'm like, I don't know. Like I visualize how far he is and then I try to decide how many feet that is. Like I have to go through this permutation where what the character really wants to know is, can I hit this guy with my ray of frost?
right.
And if the character was, or if the player was just like, hey, can I hit this guy with Ray of Frost? I'd just be like, yes, you can, or no, you can't. And we wouldn't even have to worry about how many feet away they are, you know, because I have a picture in my head and I look at that and I say, does he look too far away for Ray of Frost or not? You know, I don't have to. But when the player just says how far away, they want a number in feet. And I don't know why they want that number. So I'm like, oh, well, they're 35 feet away. And then they're like, oh, crap, well, that's 5 feet too far away to do the thing I want to do. And it's like, well, if you would have just said, can I do this thing? I would have been like, yeah, sure, you can do this thing. Because it's Theater of the Mind. We're not at a resolution where 5 feet matters. You know what I mean?
Right. And so, yeah. So that's that's maybe the difference between the two techniques, right? There's there's the actual theater of the mind is more storytelling, more like, okay, I'm going to move up to a pace where I know I'm going to be able to hit it.
Yeah.
Or versus getting into an encounter, laying down the map and saying, okay, I have to move here, then I have to move here, and I can fire from here.
Yeah.
It's more of a, I move in, jolt to the left, and, you know, launch a magic missile at it or what have you.
Yeah. And I think it's more telling the DM what you want to do. And then the DM tells you if you can do that or not, where the map is more like you're looking at the map and the map is telling you if you can do the thing you want to do or not, you know?
Right. Right. So defined that way, explained that way, I don't think either way is bad. I think it's just which is going to work best for your group.
Or even for an encounter.
Exactly. Yeah. Even for an encounter.
Cause like, if you're going to have an encounter, like a mass combat where there's hundreds of people on the field, like that'd be a nightmare with the grid and minis.
I'm making that map.
You're going to spend a fortune on all those minis and
it's
going to take you an hour to set it up. But, but yeah, you know, so sometimes, you know, a given encounter might work better one way or the other. You know, there's been times I've run where I'm mainly doing theater of the mind, but for a certain encounter, I decide to draw a grid just because I feel like it'll just work better for whatever reason. Like maybe it's kind of complicated. I don't think I can convey it or something like that. But I use the grid a lot in third edition because there are so many abilities that needed it. You know, it's like, oh, I need to be 5 feet from this person to do this thing. So you kind of had to, you know. So one kind of philosophy I have with it is I tend to, because the thing with theater of the mind is it's very kind of, it's not super precise, right? Like the 5 foot thing. Like, you know, if you tell me you want to hit this guy with your spell that has a 30 foot range, I'll be like, yeah, you can do it. Even though, I mean, maybe you're 30 feet away, maybe you're 35 feet away. I mean, who knows really, you know, it's all in our imagination anyway. So I just try to, when in doubt, like favor the players. So usually if a player's like, hey, are they within range of this spell? Unless I just know that they're way outside that range, I'll be like, oh yeah, sure. You know, or well, they're a little outside of it, but you can take a couple steps up and do your spell. No problem. You know,
right.
That kind of thing. Because I think where you're going to run into problems the most often is when a player feels like, if we had a grid, I could have done this thing I wanted to do, but because it was all this loosey goosey theater of the mind, I couldn't do it. And the DM kind of screwed me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I can see where that can be a concern for, as a player, I can see that as a concern. It's like, well, in my head, I feel like I could have been able to do it, or should have been able to.
But on the flip side, if the player's like, you know, I feel like if anything, I get to do things more often because it's theater of the mind than I could if there's a grid, because there's that kind of wiggle room.
Right.
Then, you know, players will tend not, that doesn't bother them quite as much as getting screwed over. And it's really perception, right? I mean, you might not be screwing them over in either case, but it's just how they see it. You
sure. Know? Sure. Absolutely.
Because it is, I mean, it is, theater of the mind is very arbitrary a lot of times, you know, because I don't necessarily know exactly how many feet everybody is from every other person. But it also, at the same time, it can be more cinematic, and it's more like, you know, tell me the cool thing that you want to do and we'll try to figure out a way that you can do that. Where with the map, it's like, well, you count the squares. If you can do it, you can do it. If you can't, you can't, you know?
that makes total sense. And that, I think, is, that was my shortcoming in that encounter, because I was still in my own mind, I was still thinking on a grid.
Yeah.
And that has to be abandoned on both sides.
Yeah.
Both player and GM.
Yeah. Yeah. Just try to be more cinematic, I guess.
Yeah.
And be more inclined to say, yes, you can do that thing you want to do. Of course you can get line of sight to that person, you know. There's got to be some way you can do it, you know?
That's right. Think in letterbox, man.
Yeah. It's the same kind of thing like, you know, when the player is like, is there a chandelier in the room? And you're like, of course there's a chandelier, you know? It's the same kind of thing, you know? It's like, unless there's a really solid reason in your mind why there wouldn't be a chandelier, like, why not, you know?
Right.
Let them do the cool thing they want to do, because it'll be fun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Always the improv lesson. Yes, and.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on here. I appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks for listening to me ramble about patron deities.
It's okay. I have ideas now. I know exactly what kind of character I might maybe play.
Cool. We'll see. Well, yeah, the next big thing I got to do is get a little write up of all the gods.
Yeah.
Totally. But for now, I'd say if there's a Greek deity you really like, there's a good chance there's a parallel deity in Primordia, because a lot of them started as the Greek deities, and then I added a few.
Oh, cool.
Of my own creation.
Man, I have to go back and look at my mythology books.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll work on that. Probably this next week. I'm going to try and get that done. And once that's done, I can actually like start showing you guys stuff and
sweet
and all that. I just wanted to wait till I had the deities, because I'm like, that might be the first step of the concept, is what deity do I want to align with? And then where does that take me?
Right. How did it happen? How did you align to it?
Yeah. What kind of character would fit that kind of thing? Because it seems like that's the most limiting thing, because I don't want people doubling up on deities, you know. True. Where if we have two rangers in the party, like, fine, you know, but so, yeah.
Sweet.
All right, well, that is going to wrap it up for episode 178 of Game Master's Journey. I want to thank Brett again for coming on with me today and talking GMing with me. What a lot of fun this was, and I'm sure I'm going to have Brett on again in the future, especially once we do some more gaming in his campaign. We can talk more about that, and we have lots of fun things planned in that, I'm sure. As a player, I don't know all the details, but I'm really excited about where that story is going. So I'm sure you'll hear from Brett again. But thanks again, Brett, for coming on. And if you'd like to keep up with what Brett's up to, you can follow him on Twitter at that one Brett guy. And I'll have a link to that also in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com if you want to find them that way. Also, if you'd like to get a hold of the show, if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker, and you can call the Game Master's Journey voicemail number and leave me a message if you'd like. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening or both, you might even hear your message on the show. So our voicemail number is 951-GMJ-LEX-1. That's 951-465-5391. And that is also in the show notes over at starwalkerstudios.com. If you didn't get that, just head to the website and you can get it there. So if you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I'd love to hear from you. Also, on our website at starwalkerstudios.com, you can find the show notes for this episode and all the episodes of Game Master's Journey, as well as links to myself on Google+ and Pinterest, and a link to my YouTube channel. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community over on Google+, where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. And finally, you can learn about how you can support the show by becoming a patron, by making a one-time donation, by using my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon, by getting yourself a Game Master's Journey t-shirt, or by purchasing my D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. You can find all this and more at StarwalkerStudios.com. So I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.